This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to the Zurich Distinguished Visitor Colloquium today. And we are here today with the Australian of the Year 2007 here. So there's this very hard to be more Australian than Dr. Tim Flannery, I guess. Funny thing was that, well, he was named as 2005 humanist, Australian Humanist of the Year 2005. And he decided to give up humanist part and became Australian of the Year 2007. And as you all know, that Tim is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Weathermaker. And I think many of you read that. It's very inspiring work. And Tim is a regular contributor and speaker at ABC Radio, NPR News, and the BBC and the like. And in 2006, Tim co-founded the Copenhagen Climate Council. And in 2011, he became the first chief climate commissioner of Australia. So with that, please welcome Dr. Tim Flannery.
Well, I'd just like to begin by thanking everyone at the school for such a really warm welcome that I've had in the last couple of days, despite the fact it's a really sad time to be here with the events that have unfolded over the last week. It has been just fantastic to meet everyone and to get engaged so easily with the school and its business. And I've already been taken out to dinner by some students. It was fantastic and just had a wonderful time overall. I've never been to Santa Barbara before. This is my first visit, although I've been to the US and to California on many occasions. And particularly here in California, I often think about Australia and the US almost as identical twins that have been separated at birth. You know, we are incredibly similar in so many ways. And the talk that I want to give today reflects one aspect of the common endeavour that we share, which is dealing with climate change, rising to the challenges, grasping the opportunities, in very, very similar but slightly different contexts. And I think it's always worthwhile trying to see a problem like this from a slightly different perspective. We can learn a lot, I think, from each other in terms of the way that we are approaching this problem. Of course, Australia and the US are broadly similar in terms of our history. The same founding nation, the same English heritage. We had a gold rush at the same time. California had a gold rush. We faced the same ocean from opposite sides. The two countries are broadly similar in size. Australia's about the same size as the contiguous 48 states of the USA. But of course, we have had different experiences at some levels. We have a parliamentary system of government. You have a presidential style of government. So it's in that context, I think, it's worth having a look at this climate change issue. One of the things that I do feel is probably one of the most strong underlying themes in our society is that we are both settler societies, settled from Europe, but we are both societies that have experienced in relatively recent times an expanding frontier. And that has shaped our response to the land and our attitude to resource utilisation to a large extent. I find again and again I share with Canadians and Americans, or at least at the societal level, a broad view that resources are there to be exploited. We don't like the idea of limits, and one of the reasons we don't like, I think, addressing climate change is that inherent in the concept is a limit. There's a limit to the amount of pollution you can put into the atmosphere. Europeans are much more comfortable with this sort of thing, and indeed some of the developing world countries are much more comfortable with it. It's in places like Canada, US and Australia that we see a strong climate denialist community, development of it, and a strong political contest. About even the basics, about whether climate change is real or not. Another thing that we share in common with you, that Australia shares in common with the US, is a dominance of the fossil fuel industry. Here in the US, it's long been a dominance by the oil interests, but increasingly now with gas. In Australia, the coal industry has been extremely important in the development of our country and has had deep roots into the political process. You know, when Australia was settled two centuries ago, ironically settled as a result of the loss of the American War of Independence by the British. They needed somewhere else to dump their convicts, so they chose us. At that time, coal was an important resource, and the First Fleet Commander was sent out with, among his many instructions, a directive to try to identify coal resources. Within a few decades of the founding of the country, coal was being mined, and it has been mined continuously ever since. It's not well appreciated outside Australia, but Australia controls a greater share of the seaborne coal trade than Saudi Arabia controls of the seaborne oil trade. So coal has been historically very important to us. It's been not just a significant employer, but a mechanism for developing regional Australia, and as I said, has very, very deep roots in the society and in our politics, a bit like oil here in the USA. So when we deal with climate change, coal is obviously front and centre of at least the first phase of the response, and that really sharpens the issue in a political and social context in Australia. I should just say, not only are we a great exporter of coal, we are also highly dependent upon coal for electricity generation. Until recently, about 90% of the electricity generated in Australia was generated by burning coal. And our fleet of coal-fired power plants in Australia are ageing. Many of them depend upon lignite, which is a very poor form of coal. Their efficiencies are far lower than what would be tolerated today in China. In fact, if our coal-fired power plant fleet was in China, it would be slated for closure. So there are some dynamics there that are important to understand as well. The reason I give you this background is that I want to speak about recent political developments in Australia, particularly around the setting up of my current organisation, the Australian Climate Council, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. But it is important to understand the extent of the political contest in Australia. If you think you've got hard times in the US trying to push a climate agenda, I suggest you visit Australia and see what hard times are really like. It's been very, very difficult for us over a long period to start getting action. And I should just say that one of the things that's held us back has been the politicisation of the whole issue. From the beginning, the conservative side of politics in Australia has resisted the idea of climate change. Of course, there are people on the conservative side of politics who recognise this as a problem and see that it needs to be dealt with. But here I'm talking about the overall political response. It has been... It's moved in the last decade from a situation where people have said, well, it doesn't exist, climate change science is wrong, to the next phase was sort of, well, it may exist, but it's going to be too expensive to deal with anyway, through now to just quietly ignoring the issue, but still going about dismantling what you can of the climate response. Scepticism in Australia and denialism have spread because we have a partisan press in Australia as well, a bit like you, I guess, with Fox News and whatever. The Murdoch-dominated press in Australia, the News Limited press, have for a long time now had strongly skewed reporting on climate issues. The only national newspaper in Australia is part of that News Limited press and has become notorious, really, for the skewing. Not necessarily putting out wrong facts, but just the skewing of reporting around the issue. Little wonder that the public is confused, that we have mixed messages flying about, that it's difficult to develop a legislated response to the challenge of climate change. And yet, climate change is exerting an ever stronger influence on Australia. And I want to just present a slide show to you now, which documents what's happening, how climate is influencing extreme weather events, for example, in Australia, and how it may continue to influence it in future. But I should say, before I show you the slideshow, that this slideshow presentation is one of the core presentations that we at the Climate Council make to our fellow Australians to convince them not only that climate change is real, but that the impacts they're feeling in their everyday life is related to climate change. So forgive me, there's a few slides at the beginning which you've probably seen a million times, but I just wanted to show you how we present the issue to our fellow Australians. So there's still a lot of Australians who think that climate change isn't happening. It's important that they understand this graphic, that this is evidence that the atmosphere is warming and has been doing so strongly, particularly since the 1960s or thereabouts. And we explain, as you'll know, there's four lines there, four separate sets of measurements, generally concordant, and showing that the warming trend without doubt exists. We also point out that there's a lot of variability year to year in the degree of warming in the atmosphere. That's in part... Sorry about that. Won't touch that again. That is in part because the lion's share of the heat that's trapped by the atmosphere goes into the oceans. So it's something, again, that's not well understood by the Australian public. And we unpack this a little bit, just explaining how... a bit later on in the presentation, how warmer oceans change events around Australia, but also showing that if you look at the ocean record, you see a much smoother graphic. The ocean has a much greater mass than the atmosphere. It's 500 times larger in terms of mass. It responds more slowly. It's not kind of whiplashed around by changing heat transfer from effectiveness from the atmosphere into the ocean. But the warming trend is evident in the ocean as well. We try to explain that some changes are happening in advance of the predictions and projections that climate scientists make. This particular graphic here shows the decay of the Arctic ice cap over time. You can see the projections, the various projections in the coloured envelope there. But there's the black line, the real world data, which recently has dropped outside the projection range. So sometimes scientists don't get it right. Sadly, we're seeing that quite often now, in that the scientists have been rather too conservative in projecting some of the changes. How do we know that human activities are the cause of this warming trend? We show this example of computer modelling. This purple line there just really is a model of what happened, or what... looking at the 20th century, global climate for the 20th century, and just factoring into the model natural variation. So what's happening with the sun, what's happening with volcanoes and so forth. This model here, the red line, also factors in human activity. So we've got a great natural experiment there. This is a historical data set. We can see what happened in a real world, which of the two models was better at predicting real world change. And there's the real world graphics, just reflecting that very first slide that we saw, and you can see it's concordant only with modelling if you include human factors. So for the general public in Australia who still debate whether this is caused by humans or not, this sort of graphic is quite compelling, is quite good. I should just say that we show these graphics in what we call town hall meetings, where we have face-to-face meetings with between... Yes?
Can you explain this graphic?
Sure. So I wasn't quite sure how many of you are climate scientists and know this and how many are not. So I've been kind of just skimming over some of the climate science. Sure, we'll go back to the beginning. So what that little back projection envelope there represents is what would have happened with global temperature if we just factor in natural causes, so variation in sunlight, sunspot activity and so forth, volcanic activity, which can put dust up into the stratosphere and cool the planet and so forth. So all of those sort of factors. So if there was no human influence on Earth's climate, during the 20th century, the temperature should have been in that broad band. But if you do another lot of back projections and include the human pollution, so all of the CO2 pollution and so forth that we've put into the atmosphere, you get a different envelope of projections for the 20th century, which is the red line there with the upswing towards the end. So you can then ask, you've got an experiment then. You've got natural factors only and then natural factors plus human. So you can then, because it's a historical data set, you can then lay in the actual measurements, right? The actual trend for the 20th century, and there it is there. So the actual trend can only be explained if you factor in the human causes. So that's the kind of the nub of it. I just want to turn now to our reporting at the Climate Council of what's been happening in Australia in recent years. So this is looking at extremes. And climate change now is having an impact in Australia most substantially in an uptick in extreme weather events. It's been quite surprising, I think, the extent to which a small shift in average temperature has translated to a change at the extremes. We've had two extreme summers in Australia now, 2012 to 2013 and 2013 to 14. And these are some of the things we've seen. A severe heat wave across 70% of Australia in late December, early January 2013, with temperature records set in every state and territory. We had something like 123 weather records broken through that summer in Australia. Now, we don't have anything like the density of weather recording stations you have here in the US. So for us, 100 plus weather records being broken is very substantial. The hottest area ever, area averaged Australian maximum temperature, above 40 degrees on the 7th of January 2013. Hottest month on record for Australia. All-time maximum temperatures at 44 weather stations and increased daily maximum temperatures for the whole of Australia, over 39 degrees for 7 consecutive days. That's quite significant. We've only had 21 days where the average daily maximum temperature for the whole of Australia was over 39 degrees. That's since records were kept. So to have 7 consecutive days in one summer is a significant record. This is a weather map produced by the Bureau of Meteorology in Australia of the heat. This is the little thing here. You can see here this great pool of very, very hot air sitting across Australia, the great bulk of Australia through the summer. Just recently, incidentally, the Bureau has added two additional colour bars up here for higher temperatures because they haven't ever had to use them before. Now they think in future they're going to have to use them in their projections. So that was a bit of a story in itself that they had to do that. The anatomy of heat waves and their impacts on human health are increasingly well understood. This is just one example of an earlier heat wave, but that's been well analysed in the city of Melbourne in 2009. And you can see here the maximum temperatures, they going up 44 degrees, 46 degrees, and then the cool change coming. This is average mortality for the 5 years prior to this, and here's the mortality curve for that particular period in 2009. And you can see that it's the string of hot days, the fact that temperatures don't drop at night, that tend to stress people, and then we get these very significant mortality events. In fact, for all of the news media that you'll read around bushfires killing people in Australia, it's heat waves that are the greatest killer in our country and increasingly exerting an influence. Well, how has all of this happened? How is it that we've had a small change in average temperature that's brought about a big change at the margins? This graphic is what we use to try to explain that. If you can think of all weather occurring at a particular location as falling under a bell curve, you get some cold days, you get some hot days, but most days are in between. That's the sort of bell curve of previous weather. But if you shift the average just a bit, you have a big impact at the extreme. You still get some cold weather, although you get less of it. You'll get a big increase in hot weather, and you'll get a series of, an area under the bell curve of record hot weather. So that's stuff we haven't seen before. And, once you start seeing weather records broken in Australia as consistently and at such a large scale as we've seen over the last 5 years, It really is evidence that you've moved into a new climate. The climate's already shifted, and that is the conclusion that we're increasingly drawing. There are other influences of climate change on Australia. Our continent is surrounded by oceans. Oceans, because of the topography and nature of the continent, play a disproportionate role in terms of influencing climate and weather over Australia. And changes in the water cycle, the hydrological cycle, are having an impact, and it's important for Australians to understand this. So, I know that there's a lot of scientists there, I don't want to bore people, but you know, you warm the water, you get more evaporation, you get more atmospheric water vapour, you get more rainfall. And the rainfall tends to be more intense. There's an increase in intensity. Your national assessment, I think, made the point that in the US even, in places like New England, you've had a very large increase in rainfall intensity, something on the order of 70% or more. I'll come back to that that point of rainfall in a moment, but I just want to talk about sea level rise, largely as a result of thermal expansion, so far of the ocean, but also melting ice. Australia is particularly vulnerable to sea level rise. We're a coastal people. It's a flat-lying continent. And we are already feeling large impacts. These examples here are just photographs, two of them from Perth, showing coastal erosion and flooding, and this from Torres Strait in the north of our country, where there are exceptionally severe impacts. Sea level rise is quite variable around Australia. In places like Melbourne, the oceans are rising at the rate of about 2.9 millimetres per year. But over in Perth, we have rises on the order of 9 millimetres a year. Similarly, up in Torres Strait, very high rises. Why should the sea be rising differentially? Differential heating, ocean currents, so forth, play a role. I don't pretend to understand this, and if I get questions from the audience in Australia about this, I say I'll get back to them when I understand it myself, because it's a complex area of science and I don't want to mislead people. But in any case, you can see that there is very good data suggesting that sea level is rising variably around the country. But what does this do in terms of increased risk of coastal flooding? This is some work done by John Hunter, one of our finest climate scientists who works on sea level rise. And you can see here that he's factored in a sea level rise of just half a metre. So kind of in the middle of the projected range, I guess, that we're expecting at to the end of this century. And then had a look at risk of coastal flooding. So, for example, here up at Port Augusta at the head of the Spencer Gulf, we've got an area where you may expect a tenfold increase in coastal flooding. So that means that a once-in-a-century flood you may get once a decade in that area. Bundaberg, Hobart, these parts around Perth, there's a hundredfold increase. So what that means is that a once-in-a-century flood you may see every year in those areas. But these very large dots here in the Sydney area, Melbourne, and up here in the northwest, are a thousandfold increase. So there you're getting an increase in, say, a once-in-century flood to something you might see more or less every month. I mean, it's you know, the greatly increased risk of coastal flooding. And the amount of infrastructure, coastal infrastructure, we have in places like Sydney is just huge. There's something like 300,000 Australian homes which would be endangered by this level of increased flood risk. Major infrastructure assets like Sydney Airport, rail links, hospitals, schools, a whole series of things that are endangered. And the Climate Council, we're just in the middle now of compiling a report looking at risk profiles for built infrastructure in the eventuality of these sort of increased risks of coastal flooding coming about. Just again to explain for the general public why this happens, you know, we've been pretty good at building infrastructure out of harm's way under the old climate. We understand storm surge, we understand high tides, we understand flooding as it once was, and we've put our infrastructure out of harm's way. But once you change the baseline, once you factor in the sea level rise, of course, storm surge, extreme flooding events, changes in rainfall intensity can bring our infrastructure within harm's way once again. We have had some spectacular examples of changes in rainfall intensity in Australia. I think some of the most striking examples of heavy rainfall to be seen anywhere on the planet have been experienced in Australia over the last few years. In Queensland in 2010-2011, we had a quite extraordinary wet season. Wettest December on record, floods breaking river height records at over 100 observation stations. Over three quarters of the state declared a disaster zone. Economic cost, uninsured cost this is, it to be in excess of $5 billion, and 300,000 homes and businesses losing power and being damaged. At the time all of this was happening, sea surface temperatures across northern Australia were at an all-time high, breaking all records. Increased evaporation and very, very intense rainfall events. Just go back to that. Because losses of government or state-owned assets were so large, the Australian government decided to raise a levy, which was paid by every taxpayer in Australia, around about 1.5%. In addition to your income tax for that year, was put there specifically to rebuild roads, highways, bridge infrastructure that had been damaged, government-owned infrastructure being damaged by this flooding event. In some ways, you can think of it as the first climate tax, I think, paid, because there was a climate influence on these events. And I guess as a lesson for the future, you can think about that, how we deal with those infrastructure issues and how we deal with insurance of them in the context of this being a climate tax. Ironically, at the same time that we've had... Oh, I should just say one other thing about Australia. So that was 2010, 2011. Fast forward to 2013, 2014. Queensland is experiencing the worst drought on record. More than 80% of the state drought declared. Government money again going to farmers to try to tide them over these exceptional circumstances. Our weather is just getting more and more extreme, and it's costing us in terms of government handouts and tax. So again, January 2013, the great floods are over. Conditions have changed. We are now seeing, with heat waves, a great increase in the fire risk in Australia. This is our fire weather index here on the east, on the right side of the screen. The benchmark for fire risk used to be 100 on the old MacArthur scale. That was set for the most damaging and horrific fires that Australia had experienced until recently, which were in 1939. So the 1939 Black Friday fires that killed over 100 people set the index at 100. But you can see what's happened with fire risk in our country. We had a fire in 2009 that was, you know, hard to estimate, but somewhere between 200 and 300 on the MacArthur scale. We'd never seen anything like that before. So 8th of January 2013, that band of fire weather there, which is right up here, is the sort of stuff that really strikes fear into the heart of every firefighter in Australia. If a blaze had broken out there, it would be uncontrollable. And we're finding, we do a lot of work with emergency services in Australia, particularly firefighters. The risk is just growing by the year for them, and they're not resourced to deal with it. You know, in times past, there was a sequenced fire risk in Australia. It would appear in the north first and then migrate down as the seasons change into southern Australia. And firefighters from Tasmania or Victoria would go up into Queensland to fight the early fires, and then the Queenslanders would come south and be able to have a coordinated response. We've got lengthening fire seasons in Australia now. We've got much shorter periods where you can safely backburn, so to minimise the risk. And because now the fire season is happening over a much extended period, the fire services are stretched to the limit and can't cooperate as they were before. We're facing an emerging crisis in Australia just in terms of fire management. So I should just say, earlier in the year, our Australian Prime Minister said there was no link between climate change and bushfires, so we try to make a point of explaining the link to the Australian public. And we just say that climate change exacerbates bushfire conditions by increasing the frequency of very hot days. Of course, it also increases evaporation from the soil. It has a very substantial impact. And we've seen historically that the forest fire danger index has increased significantly at 16 of 38 weather stations across Australia, most of them in the southeast. And none of the stations have showed a decrease. So as it's got warmer, fire risk has increased in southeastern Australia, which is where the greatest danger lies, because that's where the vegetation is and the population is. So when we look forward, we can see the projected increases in hot days across Australia and in dry conditions in the southwest and southeast will very likely lead to more days with extreme fire danger in those regions. And just in terms of where we are in terms of heat wave impacts, this summer which has just passed in Australia, we saw a dramatic increase in the onset of heat waves. So they're coming much earlier. In Sydney, for example, 17 days earlier than previously. We've seen an increase in the number of heat waves across southeastern Australia, and we've seen an increase in the average temperature of those heat waves. So all of that is happening. In places like Adelaide, those changes are well in advance of the projections. So this year in Adelaide, we saw 14 days over 40 degrees Celsius. The average for Adelaide for the last several decades is about 2 days above 40. If you look at the forward projections, that number of hot days, say 14, is what we might have expected to see around 2030. So again, we're ahead of projections on this. It seems bizarre that we have these great floods in Queensland, as I said, in 2010. But look at this. This is the rainfall map for Queensland between 1970 and 2012. And here are the rainfall deficits on quite a large scale. I mean, this is 50 mils per decade decrease, right? So Queensland is getting drier, despite the fact we're having these great floods, these very intense rainfall events. The science of why we're getting this drying trend in eastern Australia is not entirely settled. There seems to be a climate influence, but it's not settled. Whereas the drying in the southwest of Western Australia is much better understood. We can see the climate impact on that very, very clearly, and scientists are comfortable about attributing this, a large proportion of the drying trend in the southwest, to climate change, to the warmer conditions. The city of Perth here has seen very dramatic changes in terms of rainfall availability in its dams. Up until the 1970s, Perth's dams got about 340 gigalitres of water per year into them. In 2012, that had dropped to 2 gigalitres and continues at very, very low levels. Perth is now 50% dependent for its water on desalinisation. So there have been very big changes just in recent decades in terms of water availability for some major cities in Australia. Excuse me. The Great Barrier Reef is probably one of the most vulnerable of our natural environments or habitats to climate change. We are already seeing large impacts. People here doubtless will be familiar with coral bleaching. Coral bleaching was pretty much unknown on the Great Barrier Reef prior to about the 1970s. But has since proceeded at pace, and we've seen some very dramatic bleaching events that have killed up to 60% of the reef at any one time. The reason that the Great Barrier Reef is so vulnerable, it's very, very large. It's about the size of Texas, the whole thing, and it sits on a very shallow continental shelf. So the water can warm up very quickly, and it's very hard then to flush that. There's no deep, cool water nearby to change. So that pool of hot water tends to sit over the reef once it develops long enough to cause coral bleaching and kill the coral. The reef is pretty healthy at that level of CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, 375 parts per million. It's not entirely free of impact, but it's relatively healthy. By the time you get to these levels here, plus 2 degrees, the coral really has difficulty adapting. It can't migrate readily. Migration rates are outstripped by rates of climate change once you get to 3 or 4 degrees of warming. At 2, it's barely possible. But once you get up here, 500 parts per million, 3 degrees of warming, the reef can't survive. In fact, there are some scientists in Australia who say that even with 1.5 degrees of warming, the reef ecosystem will collapse. And we're committed to 1.5 degrees now. We've had, you know, just under a degree of warming globally. We'll likely see 1.5 degrees. And I suppose it should be no surprise that that half of the barrier reef is already dead. Now, there are many factors that have... That was studies done in 2012, so 50% of the reef already gone. There are a lot of factors affecting that, but climate change is one of those influences. It and acidification are growing influences on the destruction of the reef. The final presentation that we show to our audiences in Australia concerns projections for the future. I guess you're all familiar with these projections. I'll be climate school here, but this is the business as usual scenario, as we explain it to people. But here's where we need to be. We need to keep temperatures from rising above this, what the scientists call a 2-degree guardrail. So going beyond that, we are into much more dangerous territory. I didn't get the other parts of that. There was another couple of bits. We normally, this is a graph, we find the public don't often respond to graphs in the same way scientists do. We can show that and it doesn't have an emotional response to people. So what we tend to do is put our kids on this graph, put our life. So I was born in 1956. And I live to 2040, I hope so, you know, but the sort of average temperature for my life is going to be down there somewhere. But my kids, two of them at least, were born in the 80s, and they could live right through to here, so the average temperature of their life is there. But I haven't got any grandkids yet, but if I'm ever lucky enough to have them, their life, you know, they'll be born somewhere in here, and their lifespans are going to be lived at much higher average temperatures in the danger zone. So just a way of showing to people that this is not some esoteric and distant problem. This is something that's going to impact our children and our grandchildren. We talk also about the carbon budget because that allows people with some business sense to get their heads around the nature of this problem. And here's how we frame the carbon budget problem for Australian audiences. We say for a 75% chance of meeting the 2-degree safety guardrail, we can emit no more than 1,000 billion tonnes of CO2 for the first half of the 21st century. So 1,000 billion tonnes sounds like a hell of a lot. I mean, you reckon you never run out of carbon budget at that rate. But if you look at what's happened for the first 13 years of that 50-year period, we globally have emitted nearly 40% of the carbon budget that's available. So we've only got 60% left to last 37 years, but at the rate that we're burning fossil fuels, we'll use up the allowable emissions by 2028. And after the budget's completely spent, the world's economy, it needs to be completely decarbonised. So the sooner you get on with the job of doing that, the less cost will be involved, the less disruption will be involved. So again, just a way of putting a fossil fuel equation here and just driving it home, that... So we've got about 600 billion tonnes of budget. The world's indicated fossil fuel reserves, if they're all burnt, would emit nearly 3,000 billion tonnes. So these are the valued reserves, stock market valued reserves. That means we can only burn about 20% of the world's known fossil fuel reserves. And this is why people talk about a carbon bubble, that some companies are valuing assets which cannot be utilised if we want to have a sustainable future. Our coal reserves in Australia represent about 51 billion tonnes of CO2 emissions. That's about a 12th of the world's allowable budget. So it really does matter what Australia does. I should just say, on that note, we remind people that Australia is a country of 23 million people. We're tiny, yet we're the 15th largest emitter by absolute volume on the planet. We have the highest per capita carbon emissions of any large developed country. So what we do really counts. I just want to now talk briefly about the climate response. Very little was done in Australia until 2010 in terms of government action to deal with climate change. But in that year, a new government was elected in Australia, which was Australia's first minority government elected since World War II. So the parliamentary system works that you can have a minority government if a political party is joined by another smaller party to form an absolute majority in the lower house. That's what happened in this case. It was our Labor Party, which is a socialist party. It's run by trade unions or influenced by trade unions and so forth. That was joined by the Greens. So we had a Labor-Greens coalition that brought forth a series of reforms that came under the rubric or the name of the Clean Energy Bill, which was passed through the Parliament. The Clean Energy Bill in 2011 placed a price on carbon, a carbon tax effectively of $23 a tonne, a fixed price for 3 years. Then it was going to synchronise with the market, with the European carbon market. It also created a Clean Energy Finance Corporation with $10 billion to invest in abatement of emissions. So co-invest with companies and banks to reduce emissions. It was an off-budget fund, by the way, so it's a one-off allocation. The money will be recouped by the CEFC and invested into the future. It also created a Climate Change Authority, which was there to tell Parliament what its ambition should be in terms of emissions reductions, among other things. We also committed to reduce our emissions by 5% by 2020. We had a carbon farming initiative put in place, and of course the Climate Commission was established. So that was the organisation that I was asked to head up. Our job was simply to make sure that the Australian public are aware of the facts about climate change, the scientific facts, the economic options in front of us that we have, and also what was happening internationally. So the slideshow I just showed you was part of that presentation. We were established in February 2011, and over the life of over the life of the organisation, we produced 27 reports. We had 30 town hall meetings around Australia. We developed a website, and we were reaching about 1 million people with our product per report by the end of that time. Among the commissioners was myself, Professor Will Steffen, who some of you here may know, who's a very respected climate scientist, Professor Leslie Hughes, another climate scientist with expertise in adaptation, Mr. Jerry Houston, who is the ex-CEO of BP Australasia, well-known fossil fuel company, Roger Beale, who is a very respected bureaucrat and economist. He is essentially the Prime Minister's go-to man, the one that the Prime Minister, Premier and Cabinet, he executes the decisions they make. He retired, of course, when he joined us. Professor Veena Sahajwala, who's a mechanical engineer interested in emissions reductions in the steel sector particularly. So we worked as a group. We'd turn up in a rural town in Australia, organise a town hall meeting and answer people's questions after we'd showed a presentation. That's the way we worked. By 2013, the Clean Energy Bill had a big impact on Australia. We'd been able to reduce emissions from the electricity sector. We were able to reduce the coal in the mix for the electricity sector to 69%, down from 90% a few years earlier. We saw emissions overall in the Australian economy drop for the first time. Dropped for the first time while the economy was growing. So the economy was strongly growing, but emissions dropped. Often during a recession, emissions will drop, but the economic activity also drops. But 2013 was the first time we saw a decoupling of emissions from economic growth in our country. Pathetically small drop, 0.3% for Australia, right? But we turned the curve down. Compared with the US, you've turned your curve down by 10.9% since the peak in 2008. So we are lagging badly behind in terms of you, but it was a start. And then in September 2013, we had an election and a new Conservative government was elected. The new Prime Minister is suspected of being a climate sceptic. He doesn't comment a lot on climate change these days because he gets knocked on the head by the new Climate Council when he gets things wrong. But I think it's fair to say that he has more in common with Sarah Palin than with George W. Bush in terms of his views about various things. This is a deeply conservative government. Their very first act, and if you just deal with what they've done physically, you'll see why. The first act of the new government was to abolish the Climate Commission, It was the first thing they did on coming to power. Not only abolish us, but took down our website that we'd spent years building. So us radicals, including the ex-CEO of BP, you know, radicals like that, we decided that that wasn't good enough, and we were a bit pissed off with their decision to do this as a first act of government. So we thought we'd go to the Australian public to see what they say. 5 days after we were abolished, we announced that we'd like to continue serving the Australian public in the same role. We started a crowdsourcing initiative. Within 5 days, we'd raised $1 million for our new organisation. And today, we have framed up a $1.7 million budget and continue working even more effectively, I'd argue, at that role than we did while we were part of government as the Climate Commission. And I should just say, the Climate Commission, yes, it was part of government, was paid for by government, but we were genuinely independent. But we're more transparently independent now because we're funded directly from the Australian public. It's been quite extraordinary to see what that crowdsourcing campaign has done. We've been able to convert, I think, now about 20% of our donors to monthly givers, so it gives us some longevity, which is really important. No one had done anything like this before in Australia, and I don't know whether it's been done elsewhere in the world. It was certainly the largest and most successful crowdsourcing or crowdfunding initiative in Australia's history. And that conversion to a more enduring base, I think, hasn't been seen before. Not only did people give money, but gave other things as well. We were given free premises in Sydney, rent-free premises, which was, it's an expensive city to buy office space in, so it was very nice to get that. We had 600 volunteers step forward to help us with running the organisation. Every bit as important as the money in terms of addressing this. We've already produced 10 reports. We've only been in operation now 6 months, but we've produced 10 reports. We've achieved about $16 million worth of media coverage, you know, by advertising equivalent. So if you tried to buy that amount of coverage, it'd cost you $16 million. But the key ingredient of our success, I think, is that once more climate change is on the political agenda. It's high in people's consciousness again. And people are concerned. It's a critical time for us here in Australia. The CSIRO, our premier science organisation, and the Bureau of Meteorology are both facing large-scale cuts. Even more seriously, they are both very reluctant now to speak about climate change. It's clearly evident the government doesn't like it. So they need people like us to take their facts and figures and present them before the public. In the next month or so, the fate of Australia's carbon price will be decided. Along with a lot of the other reforms of the Clean Energy Bill. The government wants to repeal them. They don't control the Senate. The Senate is partly controlled by a very eccentric mining billionaire by the name of Clive Palmer, who, among his other exploits, is building a replica of the Titanic. I don't know who's going to sail on it, but he's doing it in China, and has bought a large resort in Queensland, which he's populated with robotic dinosaurs, and now the public doesn't get in there. Very strange stuff. He said he won't support the repeal of the carbon tax unless the government gives back every cent they ever raised under it, which is impossible. So we shall see what happens. You'll hear about it all in a month's time if you read the international news. So having said that, I think I've rabbited on long enough. I do want to leave time for questions. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I found that there are a lot of common challenges that we are facing as a resource-rich country and an economy driving the growth. So, were there any questions? I feel like I saw more Australian map today than my entire life.
All right. Okay. So,
thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yes.
One thing I heard Australia is better than the U.S. with is public transit. Is that true?
Yes. If you forgive me saying better than California, I think this is a really road state. But in the northeast, you've got some quite dense cities with very good public transport, New York, for example, and Boston. Australia's very variable as well. Some of our cities are much better served than others. But I'd say probably on the whole we are better at public transport because we have had government investment for a long time in rail, for example.
So how did that work politically? Why was there that long history?
That's a very good question. I think We have had historically closer links with Britain than the US has, because you severed your links under bad circumstances a long time ago. We sort of, you know, let go gracefully in 1901, but we've looked to Britain for a lead when it comes to that sort of stuff. And I guess Britain has had during the early 20th century and late 19th century, was building a lot of infrastructure like the metro and so forth for moving people around, and we just followed suit. I think that would be the best guess.
Hi, thank you. I was interested in the policy responses that you talked about, particularly with clean energy. You mentioned in just a few years going from 90% down to 69% coal. We've had a similar thing here in the U.S. going from 60% down to under 40% coal. It's primarily been driven through natural gas, fracking, but also wind and increasingly solar. So what happened in Australia?
It's an extremely complex story. I asked economists this all the time, and they you know, say it's a lot of factors coming together. But among the key things that have happened, one is there's been a decrease in electricity demand overall. So for the last 5 years, the actual volume of electricity traded on the market has declined year on year. So that's due in part to energy efficiency. It's also due to a big rise in solar. Australia, as far as I know, leads the world in terms of rooftop installations of small-scale solar on individual households. We have something like 1.3 million installed units now around the country, so about 20% of Australians have solar power. So that means they're no longer customers to the main energy companies, the main utilities. I don't know quite why Australia is so much in the lead here, but I've just installed solar on a rental property that I have, and it cost me $3,000 for less than $3,000 for 3 kilowatts. So it's cheap, it's effective, and it's running. So there's now, that's had a big influence. There's a political group now called Solar Citizens, who are those who invested in solar and want to safeguard their investment against a backlash by the fossil fuel industry. So it's been one factor. We've had a lot of rainfall, as you saw in Queensland, for a couple of years, which means that our hydro dams have been relatively full. That's been another thing. There's been a big deployment of wind in one state, in South Australia, where 30% of the energy generation now is wind, and that's increasingly penetrating the rest of the grid. The carbon tax helped as well, but I think there's something in the profoundly disruptive nature of zero-cost fuels that's having an impact on the energy market, because, they can sell in when the price is low. We've had coal-fired power plants that have had to pay $10,000 a megawatt just to shed their electricity into the grid over periods when there's been a lot of wind and solar. So the way the market's set up in Australia has tended to favour the renewables. So there's a lot of factors involved, but there's some of them.
Just on that note, I know that my friend in Australia just built a home off the grid, off the running water, and is 100% relying on renewable energy, solar. Yeah. And is that one of the factors in Australia? The new homes are built, energy independent?
It's not yet, but when we speak to solar suppliers, we find that the number of people who are requesting off-grid solutions, total off-grid solutions, is growing exponentially. It's growing very rapidly. And the key issue at the moment is battery technology and bringing batteries cheap enough and in a compact enough form to do that. But there are people now who, they'll have a Tesla, for example, or an electric vehicle. They'll have some storage and they'll have 8 kilowatts or so of power or more. And they're self-sufficient. They've got all of their transport covered as well as their household needs.
Great.
But it's a very tiny percentage at the moment.
Yeah.
It's interesting, there's a sort of positive feedback loop going on there where the more people who get solar means the companies have less customers, so they have to defray their fixed cost against a smaller customer base to pay for poles and wires and stuff. That drives up the cost, that drives more customers out into solar and so forth. Yeah.
Great. Probably David here first.
I don't know why I was lucky. Thanks for your talk, Tim. I was really struck by what you said at the beginning about commonalities between the U.S. and Australia in the sense of individualism, rugged freedom, the idea of frontier nations. Yeah. And in this country, we call it libertarianism. And I'm just curious if you had any clues from dealing with the political situation, individuals in Australia, in terms of how, you know, how do you explain to people that at some level, confronting climate change does involve infringing on people's personal freedoms?
I don't think Australians necessarily frame the problem in that way. We are much more used to working together in the face of adversity, I think, perhaps, than people elsewhere. And part of it, we have to. There's only 23 million of us. The floods in Queensland, you know, if we hadn't chipped in and put some tax money into that, they wouldn't have had a road infrastructure in Queensland. It damaged us. They couldn't have paid for the costs. And that's it's a recurring theme in Australian history. You know, we do have an extreme climate. You can have a drought that'll go for a decade, you know. And we have to work together to help farmers. Like at the moment in Queensland, 80% of the state drought declared. That means that we taxpayers are paying money to keep farmers in business until the rain returns, you know. So I think we have a much more, just by virtue of the country we live in, much greater acceptance of working together to solve problems. So when it comes to climate change, people don't mind working together as a country. The big issue that we have is some of the misinformation that's out there that the climate denialists put out to say, oh, the rest of the world isn't doing anything, so why should we? Why should Australia? It'll only disadvantage our economy to do it. So one of the things we do is produce international reports highlighting what is actually happening in the rest of the world. So I think that libertarian thread, it is present in Australia, but it's not something that we encounter when we talk to people in terms of the climate problem. Yeah.
Great. Cool.
Yeah, if there's time, if you could just briefly comment on basically your country's preparation for the next El Nino event, how that's changing at all, sort of the discussion that's occurring and your outreach to communities.
Yeah. Well, the index has just turned positive, I think, in the last few weeks. So we are all looking like it's going to turn positive. Usually by August we know, but it's looking like it's going to be positive. We've just had the most extraordinary autumn heat wave in Sydney particularly, where we've had temperatures of 28 degrees through a period of the year when there shouldn't be anything like that, and no rain. So we are just now thinking through that question. We will produce a report. We're doing one on the autumn heatwave in the next week or so, but we will produce a report come August on preparedness, and it will be around probably bushfires and drought conditions, because it's very hard to tell how big this El Nino is going to be or what the impact will be, but potentially it could have a very large impact on Australia given the rise in average temperatures. So yeah, we need to create some awareness. At the moment, it's not really in the consciousness, or if it is, it's way back down somewhere that, you know, hasn't yet been activated. But as I said, we'll know more by August.
Great. I'm sure that there are more questions, but I would like to invite you to 215 Dean's Conference Room for additional questions and discussion point. And with that, I would like to invite you for a round of applause to Dr. Flannery again.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.